Blog Talk Radio.
Number 20, April 16th, 2012. I'm your host, Tom Riddell, and this once again is show number 20. We've reached a milestone. So thank everybody out there for getting us to this point, and we'll discuss the show right now. Today's show will bring on Eric Shellman. He wrote Dead Hunger, the Flex Sheridan Chronicle, and he'll be coming on about quarter after the hour. And also, of course, if you want to find us on the internet, you can find us over at tomriddell.com/blog. That's where our Writer's Lounge blog is located at. You can go over there and listen to our shows in the Blog Talk Radio player, which is on the upper left-hand corner of that page. And just go ahead and click the author and play the interview while you read the review. Also, of course, we're on Facebook over at Blog Talk Radio site. You click on the Facebook link, that'll send you to our Facebook page, and we've hit another milestone, just like that. Today, on show 20, we have finally reached, just 3 minutes ago, 1,000 likes. So, don't let it stop there. Let's go for 2,000. What do you say? Go over there and tell your friends about us and get them over there. There's a lot of activity happening. You can leave notes there, if you'd like. If you've got something that you would like to discuss with us, leave a note. And of course, you can post some of your book reviews, not your book reviews, but if you have a book request that you'd like to get on, you can do that there also. Also, our email, of course, is twl11@yahoo.com. We encourage you to leave us an email. And all of our show spots are now taken up through July. So at the end of June, we will be opening up another segment of interviews and time slots for you from August through November. So stay tuned for that when we open it up. Go ahead and send us your email and your request. Upcoming guest authors. In the April 30th show, we will be bringing on Academy Award winner, film director, producer, and screenwriter, and also singer and songwriter, Sarah Kervachin. And she wrote Jane Was Here, a very interesting psychological paranormal novel. And I'll be looking forward to talking to her. That should be a really good show. So tune in for that, folks. And on May 14th, Jonathan Maxwell will be in, and shifting gears a little bit, from the fiction to the nonfiction. He wrote Murderous Intellectuals, and will explore and try to go inside the minds of the Nazis, some of the most notorious Nazis, during Hitler's reign of power. And that will once again be on May 14th. So don't miss that episode. Also, I would like to promote, this is the beginning of the promotion of my business, which is the MagicPenWebDesign.com site. I am offering a business that will cater to new authors and old authors, where you can come in and make a request for a web design site. And you can contact me over at that site, and that's www.magicpenwebdesign.com. And just go ahead and take a look over there and see what you can come up with, and would love to help you out. We'd love to talk to you about that. Caller instructions for today, of course, as always, when we have our author on, when Eric does come on about quarter after the hour, we will be taking calls at that time, and we will try to get you in. So be patient, stay in the line, and Robin and I will get to you. Speaking of Robin, my lovely, I used to say and or talented, but I found out that she's both lovely and talented, so we're going to have
hell
to
yeah.
bring in Robin Eduardo. Hi, Robin.
Yay! Hey.
So I had to check with some of the peanut gallery on that to find out if you were indeed lovely and talented, and they assured me that you were. So,
boy, my minions.
I think Eric might be able to let us know a little bit more about how he thinks of you too. So we'll wait for him to come on the air about quarter after.
Oh, I cannot even hold a candle to his wife. Let me tell you, she's gorgeous.
Oh.
Linda, how you doing, Linda? She's gorgeous. She used to be a model. So great matchup, and sorry, but I have to give her the crown. So
yeah, and then she's down in sunny Florida, I believe. They
mm-hmm.
live in Florida, and here I am up in snowy Minnesota. And you're
and it's 90 degrees. It was 90 degrees today here in Jersey. So
wow.
Talk about crazy weather extremes.
Seems like a world away.
I know.
What's going on with you? Any news and exciting stuff in the writing world?
Nothing really going on in the writing world. Well, I guess I could kind of sort of mention I'm attempting to rewrite and reintroduce a modern take on the yellow wallpaper. So I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yellow wallpaper.
Yes, it's a classic from like the 1880s, and you have to Google it. Just Google it, because
ooh.
I really don't think we have time for me to really go in depth into it. But I'm trying to. It's not exactly fan fiction per se, because I'm going to do my own original spin, but it's inspired by that classic story, and it is available online to read for free in its entirety. So. Not my story, the original yellow wallpaper.
I was hoping that you weren't going to tell me you were going into interior design.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, if it's real, like, gothic vampire, dark castle type stuff.
It wouldn't be yellow either with you. You'd have some really dark stuff up on the walls with blood probably oozing down or some kind of...
My bedroom has one wall that's solid black. So if that tells you anything, the rest is purple, and then the rest of the decor is like a deep blood red and tones of black and purples and stuff like that. I know red and purple is not a kind of sort of matchy-matchy, but whatever. It works for me.
Do you ever get any light in your life?
Well, not in the bedroom. I hate it when the sun comes through the window and wakes me up. So, but my husband calls the bedroom the morgue. So,
okay. I have to have
it's kind of dark.
I have to have cheery and light and open space. That's how I live.
The rest of my house is very bright and you know, lots of sunshine and everything. And I do enjoy that, but it's just my bedroom is that's my own space. Well, that and my home office is kind of
That's your woman cave, right?
My woman cave. It's where all the magic happens.
Hey, I'm
going on that
here.
Witchy-witchy!
That's for another show. We'll bring you on.
Yeah, I know. We're going to talk about horror tonight, not erotica.
And that's a good segue, because I just got done watching the series The Walking Dead on Netflix from last season. And I knew, because I was going to pick up Eric's book, that I had to get kind of initiated in the whole zombie.
Indoctrinated. Yep.
I mean, indoctrinated as it is. And I really, really did like it. And I didn't think I was going in the same way with his book, which I'll explain in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never really big into, you know, tuning into a zombie movie, because I thought I was going to watch all of this blood and gore and people.
Blood and gore, right.
And other people. But really, you know, when you look at the storylines that they put together, both in book form And I'm sure from what you read from your novel a few shows back and what Eric wrote was phenomenally good. And I was wondering what you thought, though, about the series. Do you think The Walking Dead from last season is better than the one this season? Because I haven't watched the one from this season.
Well, my opinion actually is, let's take it back a few steps. I read the comics originally that the series is based off from quite a few years ago, not that many years ago, but a few years ago anyway,
years ago.
Before I started writing my book, which is like 4.5 years ago. But anyway, and there's some parallels, but I was a little bit disappointed because it seemed like they were taking the television series in a different direction than the comic books. But, no, it's not a spoiler. I don't care. I'm going there. They redeemed it in this season. I know you didn't see this season, but they redeemed it with the introduction of a very important character in my heart, but I think also in many other fans' hearts, with Michonne, which you don't even know who Michonne is, but trust me, if you continue watching and play catch-up, you will really dig her character because her story is, like, so much better than everybody else's story. Like, who cares about anybody else's story once you get to Michonne? But anyway, the first season of Walking Dead, I believe, was a little bit better because there was a lot more zombies. There was more gore. There was more tension. And that sense of dread and, you know, who's going to survive and, you know, what's going on. And then there was the whole, you know, whatever affair that really wasn't an affair. But in a way, I don't know. I have this feeling that maybe Lori would have had a relationship, you know, with him sooner or later, even without the zombie apocalypse.
right. It's kind
you
of
know,
like
I mean, I just had my suspicions there because, I mean, people just don't, when you're mourning your husband, he's supposed to be dead. I mean, you don't hop in the sack with his best friend like 2 days later or whatever.
Well,
you know what I mean? It's
well,
he should be comforting her and leading
do,
up.
Robin. Some people do.
Well, some people, yes, some people do. You're right about that. And people do. Also, I mean, in all fairness, people do strange things in crazy situations. I mean, not maybe zombies happening. I wouldn't have any personal experience with that.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. You know, people under duress will do things to relieve the tension. And I guess sex is just one of those things. So.
And, of course, you got to have sex in you know, storylines such as that. Otherwise, you lose all the watchers and the viewers.
You know, to a certain degree, but I think that it did, as far as portraying it in the first season of the Walking Dead television series, the way they did. I mean, it does follow along the lines of the comic series. That part is true, but it really does set up a lot of what happens, you know, later on. And I mean, there was some stuff that was. The events were not in chronological order to the comics, and then the CDC thing, that was just out of left field. That was just tossed in. So I think we should just go to the CDC, and for no really good reason other than I don't even know why they threw it in. I couldn't even give a good reason.
It's interesting.
But I like the series. It is very good.
It's excuse me, I got a little frog in my throat.
No, go ahead.
It's interesting that you mentioned comic books. I haven't picked up a comic book since I was 15 years old.
Oh, I'm a huge comic book fan.
I imagine I would love to be actually sit down and go through a comic book and just read it and enjoy the art that they have and do that at some point. So I might even pick myself up a comic book. But anyways, let's get on to the main event here.
Mm-hmm.
And the book, The Dead Hunger, the Flex Sheridan Chronicle, was written by Eric Shellman and published by Dolphin Moon Publishing in 2011. You may purchase it at Amazon.com Kindle, and you can visit the author and find him on Facebook. This is how Amazon reviews the book. A phone call to his sister leads Flex Sheridan into a nightmare and a guest to save his family from a new horrifying epidemic that's turning humans into zombies. As he makes his way from Georgia to Gainesville, Florida and back, he picks up old and new friends and survivors. Flex reconnects with perhaps the strongest woman he's ever known, Jem Cardoza, his former girlfriend. Together they take his six-year-old niece, Trina, the only uninfected survivor of his sister's family, and his infected sister, Jamie, and make a run from Central Florida back to his isolated Georgia home. And that was part of the Amazon review on that. My review, when heading into a genre for the first time, especially one that is rich and overpowered with gore and much bloodletting, such as vampire novels and now a zombie novel, I'm unfortunately reminded of the poor authors and screenwriters who focus too much on the goriest acts of violence, which steers them away from telling a good story. It's a preconceived notion that many of us readers have about a certain genre, but it's also a view that can rob us of knowing a good story and a good author. Dead Hunger, the Flex Sheridan Chronicle, is a story not only about the hunger of human flesh, it's about the survival and endurance of the human spirit and the coming together of friends that will make survival possible. It's about the incredible ingenuity of the human mind when it's pushed to its limits, and it's about the pure innocence of a small child who is seeing a world gone mad right before her very eyes. Eric Shulman does a good job of taking us into the depths of his characters, and we learn to like and care for them. A bit lacking on a few elements of plot and conflict that would have added more of an interest to where the characters and story were heading, but he redeems himself in the examination of the physiology of zombies and what makes them tick. When Flex's own sister is strapped to an examination table, we learn about the true agony of what has happened and what a zombie is. I am hungry for the next installment of Dead Hunger, and with that, I would like to bring on our friend, Eric Shulman. And Eric, how are you? Whoops. You know what? I think I muted our co-host, and I will bring you on now. Eric, welcome
yes,
to the show.
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Tom. Hi, Robin.
Hey.
How you guys doing?
We're doing great. We're doing really well, and as you came in early on the show and tuned in and listened to us talk a little bit about the topic of tonight's program, which is zombies, I was wondering if you would be so kind if you could read an excerpt from your book.
I do have an excerpt, and I was trying to pick one that was short enough, so here, we'll see if I can do it. Let me kind of lead into this. This is from Dead Hunger, the Flex Sheridan Chronicles, so it's from the first book. The setup on this is Flex called his sister, Jamie, and he was on the phone with her, she deteriorated greatly, and he basically dropped the phone and started driving. He didn't know what he was going to run into, but he knew something was terribly wrong. So he has already walked in the house. He's found his brother-in-law torn up on the floor, and now he's trying to find his nieces and his sister. So that's the setup for the scene. I needed to find the girls. I backed away from the horror scene splayed out in the entry, and I moved into the hallway, gun held out. I flipped on the light, and the yellow glow washed down the hallway and bathed the living room, chasing away the shadows. Both were empty. I wanted to call the girls, but the last thing I wanted them to do was run in that room and see what I'd seen. But they already had, hadn't they? I'd heard them screaming over the phone line. Jamie, Jesse, Trina, I called. It's Uncle Flex. Don't be afraid. Come on out here if you can hear me. I'll get you out of here. Nothing. I moved down the hallway. There were two bedrooms down there, one just up on the left side. Directly across from that entry, there were two double bifold doors where the laundry room was. Not much room in there, washer, dryer, large sink. Down at the end, there was a door outside, a bathroom on the left, and the other bedroom. As I approached the first bedroom door, I heard a low thump. I stopped. There was no wall switch in this room. There was a lamp plugged into an outlet. I'd stayed in this room a lot because while it was the girls' room, when I'd visit, the girls would share a bed, and I'd sleep in the other twin-size setup, my feet hanging off the end of the tiny mattress. The lamp was right between the two beds, but the darkness was complete, and I didn't want to stumble around giving up my present location to whoever had done this. And I didn't bring a damn flashlight. Jesse, I whispered. If she was here and she was hiding, I didn't want to frighten her any more than she already was. Trina, it's Uncle Flex. If you're in here, come to me now. I'm right by the door. something slammed into my legs, and I felt it closing around me. I almost staggered back, but caught myself on the doorframe with my free hand. I recognized the feel of little arms around my upper legs. "Uncle Flex," came the tiny voice. "Mommy's scaring me." I knelt down and pulled little Trina into my arms. "Shh, baby, I got you now. Is your sister in here with you?" Her body shuddered in my grip, and I pulled her tighter to me. I felt her shaking her head no. "Mommy took her. Mommy's real sick." She wouldn't speak above an airy whisper. "Close your eyes, sweetheart. I'm taking you outside." She pressed her face into my shoulder as I scooped her into my arms and stood, backing out of the room and into the hallway. I hurried down the hall toward the door, holding her tight to me with one hand and the gun barrel leading the way like an arrowhead. As I got into the entry where Jack's body lay sprawled and exposed, she sensed it. Trina pressed her face tighter into me. I pushed open the screen door and walked directly to the Suburban. I looked in all directions. If Jamie somehow did do this, it was her I looked for. In my mind, it was still impossible. A maniac had done this, had broken in, killed Jack, and taken Jamie and Jesse while Trina hid. The six-year-old was just confused and frightened. But I had seen the handprints, the footprints. There was something really screwed up and inexplicable going on. I pulled open the truck's door and deposited Trina gently inside. She held onto my arms as I tried to let her go. "Baby, I have to find your sister and Mama, so you stay. Don't find Mama, don't find Mama, don't find Mama," she stammered, hyperventilating, her body shaking. "Okay, Trina, okay. If I find her, I won't bring her back here. But I think she's sick, honey." Trina, her face, her hair over her face and her eyes wide, said, "She took Jess. She's going to eat Jess. She was eating Daddy." And then she erupted into tears. I stared at her. I didn't know what to say to her. What she had just said was my greatest fear and what my crazy damn brain was thinking since I'd seen the horrifying scene in the entry and connected that with what I'd heard on the phone. But I wasn't in that mindset. I wasn't programmed to believe that human beings in my family that I loved, could be out there killing other human beings that I loved and eating them. "Stay here," I told her. "And when I close the door, I want you to lock it and lay on the floor, and you stay down. Understand?" She nodded. I kissed her little cheek, rubbed the back of her head with my hand, and pulled away. On the floor now. She obeyed, and I pushed down the lock and closed the door until I heard it latch. Then I headed out into the moonless night, looking for my sister and my niece, and not really wanting to find them. And that's it.
Wow, very good. And I think that excerpt that you just read really hits home with what I was reviewing about in your book, talking about how some people are kind of not so sure they want to get into the gore and the blood of a zombie story, but what really pulls you in, of course, and as any story should pull you in, would be the human element here, and that would mm-hmm. be a family that Eric so skillfully wrote about in this, especially this scene here, and I think that kind of pulls you in, wants you to know more. So that was very well written and very well read, Eric. And I was wondering, I've heard it said that you don't have a lot of experience working or spending time in the zombie genre. But what or who prompted you to write Dead Hunger?
Well, you know, when I on Facebook, all of a sudden, and it's weird because I wasn't really aware of the Walking Dead series. I mean, let's face it, there's about a zillion cable channels, right? So it's like all these shows come and go, and some are good, some suck. So I really didn't hear about The Walking Dead, but all these people, there are all these zombie people on Facebook. So I started, like, you know, I found Mark Tufo and I found some other people, and I started, like, you know, kind of, you know, checking them out, and I decided to read a zombie book. So I picked a zombie book and I read it, and I was kind of amazed at the low quality of this particular book I read. Right, and I'm not naming the author. I'm just saying that I read it. I went. It's full of cliches. It's full of errors. And while I am quite aware my book isn't error-free, I can tell you, I thought I got to be able to write a better story than that, or at least something that's more gripping and easier to follow. So that's when I decided to enter the genre, and it was really the very first time I ever wrote a book for a specific group of people out there that I kind of had the feeling would read any zombie novel that came out as long as it was decent. So I thought, you know, I'm going to try it. So I did, and I just had a blast writing this book. It's like from the start, it was just fun because, let's face it, it's zombies, and And we all know what they do. They eat brains. You know?
Yeah.
So you can pretty much go anywhere, can't you?
Yeah. Eric, I'm sure you do know our co-host here, the lovely and talented Robin. Robin,
yes,
you got any remarks or questions for Eric?
No, I thought that was really great that, you know, that he's saying basically he's coming from a position of not being, you know, an OG, you know what I mean, the old gangster, original, you know, zombie fan of the genre, and then to come into it and then write such a fantastic story, which really appeals, because it has a little bit of everything, which is what we need, because so many people are saying that, you know, the zombie genre, it's dead. It's done. It's been done to death. But I still insist that when you have a good human interest story involving characters that you can relate to and you can kind of insert yourself into the, you know, that whole doom and gloom and dread and fear and, you know, all of that, when you could do that and then have an equal combination thrown in of, you know, the gore and the blood and everything, because you really have to have both, because otherwise zombie fans won't read it either, you know what I mean?
No, I
so,
agree. You can't turn off the zombie fans by going too tender and personal and human, because
right.
The humans are only contrasted by the inhumanness of the zombies, so you got to have it, and also in a world where this has happened, I mean, you really have to believe it. And
mm-hmm.
when you write this, you have to say, what would I do? What would be going through my head? At first, I wouldn't even be believing this was really going on. I'd say it's got to be something else. And then when you realize that it is happening, then it's just pure horror. But at the same time, you know, look, if I don't buck up here and,
mm-hmm.
you know, strap on some huevos, I'm going to be in big trouble here. So, people often go, well, they seem to turn into badass zombie killers awfully quick. I say to myself, you'd better turn into a badass zombie killer pretty
mm-hmm.
quick. Because if you don't, you're going to be dead.
Yeah,
I think, Robin, and correct me, and go ahead and comment and jump in there, Eric, but I think she made a good point regarding, you know, the genre is dead. There's too many zombie stories out there, but I would push into the conversation here the idea of the vampire. How long has the vampire story been around compared to the zombie story? I would say the vampire
story has been around
a lot longer than the zombie story. So,
thousands of years.
Yeah, like I was.
You want to get technical?
I was saying earlier is that, you know, you need a good storyline, and
mm-hmm.
as you have a good storyline, I think any genre isn't going to die as long as you keep that in mind to make sure that you
mm-hmm.
inject an interest, and not just. Sorry, I've never been a fan of the Friday the 13th series,
mm-hmm.
The slash 'em up, kill 'em screaming type of movies. With absolutely no redeeming quality as far as storyline's concerned. So, Eric, would you agree with me there?
Well, absolutely. And see, I say, look, a book can be about, to me, really, a book can be about anything. It can be about, you know, I mean, I know I don't want to make it sound mundane and boring. It can be about building houses. It can be about starting a new colony out in the middle of nowhere. It can be about
mm-hmm.
anything at all. As long as your characters are compelling and believable.
Mm-hmm.
Because, see, I wanted my characters to do what made sense. I want the reader to say, that's what I do. I don't want the reader to go, don't go in there. What are you, stupid? Don't go in there. Blind people don't do that unless they're really, really well-armed. And then they'll go in there with great caution, you know. So it's not like they're just running around doing stupid things, making the reader cringe. And that's what I think is really important. They just have to do what makes sense to the reader so that they don't feel like they're being, you know, bamboozled by idiocy. And that's not what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't write it for 12-year-olds, and it doesn't sound like it was written by a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a book thing recently, a book signing event at a reading festival. And you know how many kids came up? They loved the posters and they loved the covers. But I had to tell their parents, no, I'm sorry, it's, you know, these are kind of some foul-mouthed characters here and may not be right for them yet.
Right.
Some of them bought it anyway. I was very, very proud at that moment.
Yeah, it kind of leads me kind of leads me into the next question. This was a departure from the other books you have written. What were some of the challenges that you encountered in writing this genre and in crafting a fiction tale in general? Because I know that you've written nonfiction also.
Well, and it's funny because my nonfiction was really criticized initially because it was, I would call it creative nonfiction, because it was written, there's a story of a little girl named Mary Ellen Wilson who was abused, severely abused, in 1870s. Well, actually, from late 1860s to 1870, she was ultimately rescued by the SPCA. It was the only group that had the wherewithal to get this child out of this abusive home in New York City. So they did it in 24 hours after discovering her situation. But I wanted it to read, because I was so passionate about the story, I wanted it to read like the dramatic story of Mary Ellen from the beginning of her parents coming from Ireland and England to her, you know, all the way through her abuse and right to her rescue and to the court trial. I wanted it to be like you were there reading it, living in New York in 1870s and feeling what it was like. So I didn't write a documentary. So it's more of, again, creative nonfiction. So it's not that big a departure. And again, it was a sidestep from what I really wanted to do. I wanted to write supernatural fiction. And I found this story, and it kind of made me sidestep, because after 100-something years, nobody had written a book about this little girl. And she was the first child ever rescued in this country from an abusive home. So
wow.
I couldn't understand why, with her being really the impetus of the whole child protection movement, nobody ever wrote a book. So I did. And that was my first book. Now, writing fiction, true fiction, to me wasn't that difficult because, well, let me put it this way. Oh God, the older you get, and I hate to say this because I don't want young writers to be discouraged. Like, damn, I have to get older before I can get better. But the more years you get on you, I just think the better you get at developing characters and emotion and relationships, because it just happens. You experience it over your life, and you're better at writing it. So if I wrote Mary Ellen, if I wrote Out of the Darkness today, it's called Out of the Darkness, the story of Mary Ellen Wilson. If I wrote that today, I think it would be a much better book, because I wrote that in 1996, 1997. It came out.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you when you wrote that. I'm going to have to look that up and read it. And I imagine that after you were to reread what you wrote, you would probably add a lot more based on the human experience, of course, which you just touched on.
Yeah, I absolutely would. And, you know, and when I was done with that, I wrote a serial killer book called Reason to Kill, and then I put it on the shelf. I mean, I wrote that book 10 years ago plus, and then I put it on the shelf just because I was so tired of that thing by the time I finished it. Because literally, you guys know what I mean. You write a book,
I hear
you spend so many years on it, you just don't want to read another page of it. You're dead sick of it. And so that book sat on the... I put this thing to a writer's critique group that I was with at the time, and they all came back, and my gosh, I had to read each of their critiques, you know, and all the markings and everything. So I think I read that book 50 times before it was finally put on the shelf. And then 10 years later, by the time I got to Florida, after I wrote Dead Hunger, I decided I'm pulling that old book out, and I'm going to go back through it, and I'm going to fix it, whatever's wrong with it, and put it out. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
So... And
well, you know, you could come from a position of having fresh eyes. You know, it's always good in writing to, you know, step away from it for a little bit, even if it's a week. You know what I mean?
That's
it could be
true.
Any amount of time, but to come back to it with fresh eyes, you do see things that you just kind of inadvertently overlooked as you were writing it before. You know, because
absolutely.
You know what you meant, so, you know, you kind of, I don't know, your brain kind of glosses over it when you're in that, you know, the revision and editing stage, when you've been doing it over and over and over again. So if you do set it aside and then come back to it a week, a month, a year, 2 years, whatever it takes, you know, it is, it's fresh eyes and a fresh perspective, and you're coming from a completely different point of view, almost this equivalent to an outsider.
That is true. Now, there's another book, too. It's Generation Evil, and this is my witch novel. Now, Generation Evil was very similar. I wrote it around the same time, but I got 57,000 words into the book, and then I dumped it because I got so confused about where to go with this book. See, it has the problem is it has four original witches, right? They are executed in back in, you know, 1694. Then they are reincarnated generation after generation after generation, and they have this purpose, right? But I don't really mess with all the middle incarnations. Then we come present day, right? And then you have four new characters. They are the original four witches, but now they're four modern characters in Laguna Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they go back one life into their previous life to discover who they really are. So this is really four or three characters for each of the four characters. And my God, I got so confused. I just put the book down. So
you need a map.
After writing Dead Hunger and then after writing Going Back to a Reason to Kill, I said, I am going to pick up that dang witch novel and I'm going to finish it. Well, Robin, just like what you said, you step away for a month, a year, or whatever. I do not recommend stepping away from anything for 10 years because when you go back, you go, what the hell was I going to do with that? You know, because I had this great, some idea I sure had, and I started off on this road, but that road ended in a bridge that just dropped me into a ravine.
You needed to leave some breadcrumbs or something to find your trail.
I don't outline books. I just write from the hip, and it's called automatic writing. I didn't really know what it's called, but that's what I do.
When did you first decide that you wanted to be a writer, and what was it like after, as you just touched on, publishing your first book? Give us that experience of how a writer feels when they've published their first book, and like I said, when did you decide that you wanted to do this thing called writing?
Well, you know, it's funny because I used to write poetry and stuff as a little kid. I mean, I think it was pretty good. I was always rhyming because to me a poem wasn't a poem unless it rhymed. So when I was a little kid, I'd write, you know, poetry. And then when I got into my teens, all the angst, right? Every time a girl would screw me over, I'd write this, you know. Every time I'd fall in love with her, I'd write this beautiful poem about the love, right? And then once she screwed me over, I'd write vitriolic poem about the evilness of that woman that broke my heart. So anyway, my brother Gary, my late brother actually passed away. He came home, you know, he goes, hey, I'm writing some stories, you know. So he wrote this story, I think one called The Gift, and I was reading him, and I'd go, you know what, man, I'd like to write. You know, I used to write poetry and stuff, but I'd like to write stories. So I started banging out all these stories, and my goal was obviously to get published. So I was putting out these weird stories, like one called Boys Like It Loud, about, you know, boys who love loud music and then their eardrums end up getting blown out of their heads. I mean, just really kind of ridiculous stuff. So I was writing all these stories one after the other and just sending them out like crazy to these different small press magazines trying to get published.
This was before that, right, Eric?
Yeah, this is way before all these books. And when I got into the books, I finally decided, you know, I had one story published in a newsletter called Night Owl's Newsletter out of La Porte, Texas. And they paid me $2 for it. It was called The Crossing, about an old, blind and deaf homeless woman trying to cross the street. And they published it, and that was my first paid job. I got to write off all of my expenses, and I had really literally thousands of dollars in expenses and computer equipment. But for that $2 payment, I was then an official paid writer, so I could write everything off. So I did. Tax evasion. No,
it validated you.
Yeah, and
it
so
did.
You could say, go on
and
call an author. You're finally an author.
I was paid for my work. $2, but I was paid. So anyway, that's it. I decided, okay, short stories are too hard to get published anywhere. So it's time to write a book, and that's when I found this book on amazing but true stories, and I thought I would find a little true story, and I would build on it into a fiction, supernatural fiction novel, like a strange but true story. So I went in and found Mary Ellen, and it didn't lend itself to supernatural fiction because it was already a pretty cool story. So I decided to be the first writer to write the book on her, and I found Stephen Lazarus, who's my co-author. He's a physician who put a decade of research into that story before I met him, and he offered to collaborate with me. So that's how I got started, and that was our first book. And when I first held it in my hand, I was amazed, you know. But it was self-published. I'm not saying Dolphin Moon Publishing ain't mine, because it is. But at this point, I'm so darn spoiled about publishing my own work and doing all my self-promotion. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give a publisher my money. I'm sorry, I don't, you know.
Well, that aligns with the new technology now, with everybody, you know, really jumping on to create space. And previous to create space, there was Lulu. And, I mean, then, even previous to that, there was the vanity presses where you actually paid to get published, and that's a completely different animal. But the self-publishing thing, like going through Amazon.com with their create space model, is, I mean, you put in every bit of work. I mean, if you're serious about your craft, you're putting in every bit as much work as a quote-unquote legit author. You know, you're paying an editor, you know, you're going through the revisions, you know, you're doing all the promotion yourself. You're doing everything that you possibly can, just right. at a smaller scale. But you know what? The royalties, you know, a lot of these pro publishing outfits, they give you 10%.
Yes,
you know,
do.
Where on CreateSpace, you know, it's 35%, 70%. I mean, you know, the sky's the limit. And you know, if you're really good at promoting yourself and you really push it like it's a job, like it's a business, and you know, you've branded yourself and you're writing and you know, really go that extra mile, you can make some money doing it that way, and there's nothing wrong with that. I don't see the difference other than the extent of promotion.
There's always that validation thing. Okay. A real, quote-unquote...
Oh, the gatekeepers, yeah, I know.
...doesn't think I'm good enough. Or maybe, you know, at this point, though, I'm so reluctant to even submit to them because I'm afraid they would say yes. I mean, isn't that weird?
I hear you.
My second book, which was just a compilation of all the Mary Ellen documents, court transcripts, newspaper articles, and everything from 1874, was published by McFarland. McFarland is a major academic publisher. Guess what I made? I mean, over 7 years, I think they sold must have been 400 books. And because they priced the sucker at $39.95 for a trade paperback. And I was appalled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, okay, so finally after
seven years,
I contacted McFarland and said, give me the rights back. You guys have sold nothing. And they said, okay, fine, we revert the rights to you. They sent me a letter, and I've already made more money off that book than just 3 months than I did
on your own, right?
7 year run. Yes.
Yeah,
so
that's why
it's
so important to make sure that we do on the show, as we have, Robin and I have been promoting self-publishing, and it's not the evil thing that a lot of people had thought in the past, where they thought you needed a traditional publisher. But Eric, I was wondering, how long did it take you to write Dead Hunger, and where do you go to write? Is there a special place in your home or somewhere else that you prefer to sit down and write your craft?
A lot of Dead Hunger was written sitting in my bed with my laptop because, you know, you got to fit it in, and plus I work full time. So I'd go into my office, I'd put on Buckethead radio on Pandora,
yep.
And Buckethead's kind of cool because Buckethead is like an instrumental mostly. So I'd put this on my, you know, headphones on and just start jamming away. Dead Hunger took about 3 months, actually no, 4 months to write. And it's amazing to me, too, because it's the first book I ever wrote that quickly. And then Dead Hunger 2 took literally 2.5 months to write, and it's 70 pages longer than Dead Hunger 1. And I don't know. I can't even explain it. But when I'm in the groove,
yes,
the words are just flying off my fingertips. And
I was just going to say that your second book, you must have been in the zone. I was going to use that word, but...
they were pulling me. I was like hanging onto the rope, and they were yanking me along. That's what was going on with those characters.
And in regards to that, also in the process of writing and developing your characters, do you find that they control you more, or are you in control of them? We've talked about this in other programs.
Yeah, no, I have no control of them. In fact, my character Jem surprised me big time twice, and I mean, I think all of them, Flex and Jem, both surprised me at least twice in this last book. And I just went, wow! What did she just say? Really? You know? And
they create a life of their own.
Yeah, it is true. And then you know what I'd do is I'd write it, and then at night in bed I'd read what I wrote to Linda, right? So I'd read however many pages I blasted out that night, and usually it was about 2,500 to 3,000 words. So I'd read that to her. But when I read it, the weird part is it would be like reading it for the first time because I can still open Dead Hunger or Dead Hunger 2 and open it up any place and kind of enjoy what I'm reading, which is really a different thing for me, you guys, because, but honestly, I was so sick of every book I'd ever written by the time it was done. These two, having written them so fast, I'm really not sick of them yet, and I'm still actually entertained by what I'm reading, which is, I don't know, that's self-indulgent, I think, but I can't help it. I like it. I've enjoyed it.
When these characters get into your head, did you ever get the eerie feeling that you're dealing with a personality illness, you know, where you kind of think, well, I'm a writer, but these people are in my head, and I can't get them out, and they want to go where
NPD.
They want to go.
Well, yeah, because you're a little bit of all your characters, aren't you? And they're all a little bit of you. And
absolutely.
So I don't know how much of Trina, the six-year-old girl, I am, but she does say the F word a lot, so maybe that's me too.
In fact, I wanted to touch on that segment in the book was so real and so realistic that I could actually see that actually happening and hear that little girl talking, because I can't stand, and I don't know how you feel about it, Robin or Eric, but I have a really hard time with some of these authors who decide that they're not going to use any swear words in their stories. I mean, I understand some of the Christian books that are out there don't use them, but in reality, it's not reality.
You're right.
Yeah, you're right.
And zombies have taken over the world. My God, how are you going to describe this? How are you going to respond?
Yeah.
Are you going to say, well, gee willikers, I can't believe that zombie's trying to eat my brain. That's
yeah.
ridiculous. You know, you're going to say, holy blank. This son of a whatever is, you know, I mean, let's face it. The world has been, you know, it's a zombie scourge. So you say what you got to say. That's why they knelt down and told little Trina, honey, it's a new world. You say whatever you feel like saying. I've got a great scene. I'm going to give you a peek here for the next book. Because they're going to be sitting there, and they're going to be playing, the little girls are going to be playing, you know, they're playing a game, a little card game. And all of a sudden, Trina looks at her friend and goes, F off. And Jem walks by and goes, Trina, you come here right now. And she goes, we're playing a card game, Jemmy. And she's going to go, well, what's a card game called? It's called F Off. And she goes, well, what is it? She goes, well, it's really just go fish. So,
oh, there you go. Good.
You know, really, I don't have that card. F Off. So I thought it'd be kind of a cute.
It'd be interesting to hear from you, Eric. Which is the character in Dead Hunger which is most like you? We touched on that a little bit ago when you were talking about character development, but which one is the one that is kind of you the most?
Well, I'd have to say, because mainly it was in first person, and this, oddly enough, is the very first book I ever wrote in first person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd have to say Flex, because the first one is in Flex's voice. I'd like to think that I could respond and act like Flex, but I can tell you I do have the emotion and compassion that he has. And I think I modeled kind of the little girls are, you know, prior. Obviously, Jesse didn't last long, but after my goddaughters, because I since they were little babies, I was with them, and they're both girls, and they're just sweet and beautiful, and I would just be terrified if they had to go through stuff like this. So, yeah, I'd say that, you know, being with them and watching them grow up and stuff helped me relate as Flex to them. So, yeah, I'd have to say it's Flex. But like I said, all the characters have a little bit of you in them, don't they?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, in real life, I'd like to be as badass as Jim, to be quite honest.
Jim is
if
badass.
If it was necessary.
Yeah.
So that's the answer to that.
Go ahead, Robin.
No, I know, aside from the next question, I know that, you know, we're going to ask, aside from the books that you have written, you know, what could we look forward to in the future? I'm sure you must have book three or something.
Oh, yeah.
You can't just stop where you are. Hello.
Well,
so,
you know it's coming. Yeah,
I know
it's
coming, but I have to ask the questions because, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of our audience.
Right, you're
yes,
a professional
you
co-host of the program, right?
You guys are doing a great job of leading me right into that intro. Okay, so, yeah, the next book. Now, here, I got to tell you, though, please, if you guys read Dead Hunger and you like it, Dead Hunger, the Flex Sheridan Chronicle, Dead Hunger 2 is already there. I had one girl get very upset about the cliffhanger ending. So when she got upset about it, she gave me 4 stars instead of 5 stars. She goes, I love this book. I hated the ending. So I went, all right. So she got really upset that it was a cliffhanger. Because of her input, I didn't cliffhang the second book, but I felt it ended exactly where it should have. So yes, Dead Hunger 2, the Jem Cardoza Chronicle, is already done and out there. So if you read the first one, the second one's waiting. Dead Hunger 3, the Hemp Chatsworth Chronicle, that's coming. His name is Hemp Hill. He's British, but he goes by Hemp. So Hemp Chatsworth Chronicle is 10,000 words in, and I moved, so I had to stop writing on it for a bit, but I'm ready to pick up the keys and start going. But yeah, that's available. And then I've got other ideas. There's going to be a couple of spinoffs here, too. So it's going off. We've got a new character's name, Lisa and Dave, brother and sister. They're going to take off to California, I think, for a fourth book.
Cool.
Very good. Yeah, I'd like to just kind of jump in here and let everybody know that if you're out there listening to the program, I didn't give the phone numbers earlier in the program, but it's 626-213-5613, and you can call toll-free at 877-878-1436. We have about 8 minutes left, so go ahead and get your phone calls in, and I will ask the next question, which will be, this is something I've always wanted to ask the other authors on the program, and it just came to me when I was looking over your book and your writing, Eric, but who is the first author, writer, that pops in your head that you would like to sit down and have a nice long chat with, what would it be your first question to him or her?
Oh, you know, I would have to say, at one time it might have been Stephen King, but at this point it's probably Dean Koontz, because the guy was so prolific, and I know some people have been a little disappointed in his, I guess, efforts to impress with the English language in some cases, it seems. But some of his theories are so amazing, like, The Odd Thomas, those are excellent books to me, all of them. And I all the way back to Watchers and some of his great ones, and Intensity. Guys, Intensity is probably one of the most intense books I've ever read. They did a television movie, which was amazing. So if I could sit down with Dean Koontz, it's funny, though. He's fantastic. I just don't know that I'd just rather just sit down and have a chat. I can't think of anything specific I'd want to ask him. But I can tell you, I think it'd just be interesting just sitting down and hearing how his mind works.
Yeah,
and
get into his head.
Yeah, because, you know what I mean. It's like,
I know.
I don't know if I need his advice as much as I used to. But I'd still like to talk to him, because I'm sure I could glean a lot of stuff from him. Believe me, I don't think everyone's got a lot to learn, and I included. So, but yeah, him or King, I'd sit down with either one of them.
Yeah, that's been my dream, is to actually sit down with Stephen King and hear what's inside of his head. And of course, with all these years and all the books that he's written, and all those deep, evil thoughts that swim around in his head before he puts pen to paper, I'd probably be sitting here for a month trying to figure the man out. But he's an interesting fella, and it would be a lot of fun to sit down and talk to them. But I have the privilege of sitting down and talking to the authors here every 2 weeks, which I find more than interesting, I think, because these are new authors that are coming in that are probably going to hopefully turn out someday to be a Stephen King. And with that being said, Eric, we're kind of getting close to the end of our show here. We have a little over 5 minutes. And any other subjects that you'd like to touch on from your book, and where can listeners go to find you on the Internet?
Well, you can go to, if you go to Facebook.com, Create Your Fate, that is my username there. So if you search for that, or just search for Eric A. Shelman, author, that's one L, S-H-E-L-M-A-N, you'll find me there too. I don't really have my own webpage. I feel like I'm kind of hanging out there at that point. The social networking has worked out very, very well, as long as you don't overpromote, right, Robin? Not in the Kindle Horror Book Readers Club.
We've heard all about
I eat
that,
spammers for breakfast.
That's right, you do. But, no, it's good. You do a good job at monitoring that. But I do want to mention, here's one thing else I want to mention. This is not self-promotion, but it's one of my favorite books early that I read a long time ago. Whitley Strieber, or Strieber, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but
Strieber,
Wolfen.
I believe.
Wolfen is one of the best books I've ever read, one of the most terrifying books, and made into one of the most horrible, stupid movies in the history of the world.
I know.
So if anybody ever listens to me right here, remake Wolfen, and you can do it with, you know, CGI or whatever, but you can make those creatures way more what they should be. Scary.
Yeah, the ending of the film with the when she changes while she's doing the newscast or whatever it is, and she has she's like a white, she looks like, I don't know, like a Shih Tzu or something.
Yeah, but they look like German Shepherds. It's ridiculous. These creatures
are
so unique.
But hers was especially funny because it's like, what is this?
Yeah.
I don't even know what breed of dog she was, but it wasn't scary.
It was so 80s. That movie was so 80s.
Yeah, it was.
And, blah. Okay, anyway, so that's my last comment. But anyway, check out Dead Hunger, Dead Hunger 2. See if you get into them. If you do, 3 will be waiting for you soon.
Yeah, there's so many
things
out there on the television that we could do a much better job with, I think, if some of our writer friends would sit down and pen a good story like you just suggested, Eric. So once again, thank you for coming on the show, and we'll be looking to hear more from you in the future with your future publications, and we wish you nothing but success in those endeavors. And with that, Eric, we're going to let you go.
All right, Tom, Robin, thank you guys so much. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a lot of fun, Eric. Thank you very much.
Yep. All right. Bye-bye. I'll be listening in. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, and I think I just, there we go. We you did it again. Robin, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I muted you and left him on the air. I don't know if that's a sign of things to come or what. I don't know. But so here we are at the end of another program. Once again, it's our 20th show. I'd like to once again get in to thank everybody, yes, and my fabulous co-host. Thanks you also for being a part of the show for the 20th episode. And thank you for hitting 1,000. We couldn't have done it without you folks, and we look forward to 2,000. And once again, if you're interested in a web page, my promotion here is go over to magicpenwebdesign.com and leave me a free estimate, and we will see if we can hook you up with a nice website. So with that promotion and the lovely and talented Robin fading into the background, we'd like to thank you for listening, and tune in next week when we will have on the Academy Award-winning director, producer, and screenwriter, Sarah Kravchen, as she tells us more about her book, Jane Was Here. And with that, Robin, as we always say, good reading and good writing, and we'll see you next time around.
All right, good night.
It's dark as night in the middle of the day. Your faith and your fences have been blown away. You're down in the cellar and you've locked yourself in. Ah, but it looks like it's rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. God spoke to Noah one beautiful morn. He said, Noah, get ready, for the sky will be torn. Build as I tell you, save what you can. Then wait while the rainbow weather begins. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. Trouble will come, but trouble will go. You're living in fear, but what do you know? You know that the sun's always coming then. You know there'll be rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds will part and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. Like it's rainbow weather. Yeah, it looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart.